This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Topping the big local stories this week, state authorities are still trying to assess the magnitude and the impact of the mishandling of tens of thousands of drug samples at a state crime lab in Boston.
We will absolutely be sharing all sorts of information with the district attorneys as soon as we get our hands around exactly what the information is.
Meanwhile, after 27 months of negotiations, Boston teachers and the city finally reach an agreement on a new contract.
What this contract will achieve is a fundamental shift in the way our schools operate and meet the needs of all children.
And in the race for the U.S. Senate, Elizabeth Warren tries out a softer image, but is the first to go negative on the airwaves.
I don't know about Scott Brown. He's been siding with the big money guys.
And Massachusetts Republicans hold off on adopting the national GOP platform.
And we're going to dive into all those stories and more. And joining us now is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. Hey, David, great to see you.
Hi, Anthony.
Happy Friday. Also with us from NPR in Washington is Garrett Quinn, correspondent for Reason Magazine and the author of the Boston Globe blog, Less is More. Garrett, happy Friday to you.
Hey there, guys. Wish I could be in studio with you.
Well, we're happy you're with us nevertheless. So let's start with this colossal and expanding scandal at the state crime lab where heads began to roll this week. The director of the lab, Linda Han, resigned. A senior chemist, Julie Nassif, was fired. All this in the wake of revelations that another chemist, Annie Dukin, routinely mishandled evidence testing in more than 30,000 criminal cases. Here's Michael O'Keefe, district attorney for the Cape and the Islands, who met this week with Governor Deval Patrick and AG Martha Coakley.
Our concern is the defendant who potentially did not receive a fair trial because of what may be tainted evidence from this laboratory. That's what we're focusing on at the moment so that we can clean up a mess that's not of our making.
So, David, let me start with you. I know you've been doing a lot of work on this story. Where does this case, this mess, as he says, not of his making, not of their making, lead next?
More than a mess, it leads to a black hole, really. We have a black hole of court resources, of time, of legal resources. And, you know, where it should lead to, whether or not it does, is a from a bottom to the top evaluation of a system that's constitutes a complete failure of protocols, a complete failure of management, and a complete failure of common sense, where one chemist was allowed to do more damage than Typhoid Mary. I mean, when you think about it, think June 2011, irregularities appear. This woman is allowed to testify until January of this year. She continues to take the stand as an expert witness, and she's analyzing 2 to 3 times as many samples as your cohorts. Something should say, hey, maybe we should check out with the failure rate. The failure rate, by the way, is the percentage of cases that test not to be drugs. Nobody does that. So you don't do that. And if you want an indictment of the system, here's where the indictment is. And this is why it needs to go all the way to the top. This is a letter from the head of the laboratory in the State Department of Public Health to the district attorney, explaining why it took 6 months for the lab to notify headquarters. Quote, the laboratory managers had not reported this incident to the central office because they did not appreciate its potential legal significance. What in the world did they think their job was?
What were they thinking?
It's not a professional statement, but that woman has since resigned. What were they thinking?
Garrett Quinn, what's your take on where this story is going next?
Well, my understanding is you're looking at the potential of 34,000 cases of that may be tainted and have to be reevaluated and may have been, for lack of a better term, a miscarriage of justice. And a lot of these are drug cases. And you know, there's a huge difference between getting caught with a small amount of of a hard drug and a large amount. And if you're from some of the reports I've read, this lab person changed the levels of drugs that were involved in certain cases, that can add 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases to a prison sentence. That can really ruin somebody's life as opposed to getting caught with one pill or several pills. This is just going to snowball, I think.
Yeah, and here's a case in point, speaking of how it's going to snowball. And a defendant named David Danielli pleaded guilty to possession with intent to distribute distribute oxycodone, he was sent to jail. But it was Annie Dukin, this chemist, who tested those drugs. So now Daniele's attorney has requested that he be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea and be released from prison. That's one of 34,000 cases.
Now, this gets to be the really difficult ones. When you have a conviction based on fabricated evidence, that's pretty clear. But when you have, and because of these mandatory minimum sentences, people reach pleas. When you have people pleading out like this guy, now you have to go back and figure out what percentage of a factor in that decision was that sampling of that and of that particular drug sample. So you have a tremendous problem with this. And also, of course, a lot of these drugs don't exist anymore. They've been destroyed.
Well, we spoke this week with Ed Ryan. He's a defense attorney. He's the former president of the Massachusetts Bar Association. I want to play you a little bit of what he told us. He says the problem here is that law enforcement has too much involvement with the state crime lab. So let's listen to what he said.
There should be a single state agency that is independent, not beholden to the police, not operating at their direction. It should be an independent, neutral body of scientists operating under rigid protocols with some checks and balances. We don't have that here in the Commonwealth, and I am very concerned it's the cat watching the chicken coop.
What do you think, Garrett Quinn? Is Ed Ryan on to something there?
Yeah, this is a catastrophic failure. I don't really think there's any other way to put it. And all across the board, you know, this, what is the average? I think something the average worker in these situations handles, it's a couple thousand of cases a year. This woman handles something like 60,000 or something. It was ridiculous.
She's handling about 9,000 a year. But
9,000, yeah.
But
ahead,
can
David.
I say something? Let's look at the bigger picture here. One thing, this is a call to reflect on why State Attorney General Martha Coakley was on the wrong side of history. When she personally argued in front of the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, in 2009, she was arguing against the proposition that a defendant should be able to confront the person who performs the drug test used against him at trial. Now we know why a simple certificate from a drug lab is not sufficient, and why, as the Supreme Court's ruled, that defendants should be allowed to cross-examine chemists about the evidence, which in this case turns out to have been completely fraudulent.
Well, we look forward to seeing how this story continues to unfold as more and more reporting, such as yours, David, comes out. But let's move on, if we can, to the week's other big story. That is, of course, the agreement between the Boston Teachers Union and the city regarding a teacher's contract. And it includes a 3% pay raise and changes in the way teachers are hired and evaluated. Here's Superintendent of Schools Carol Johnson.
What this contract will achieve is a fundamental shift in the way our schools operate and meet the needs of all children.
And here's Richard Stutman, president of the Boston Teachers Union.
We agreed on a proposal for performance evaluation that both of us could live with and both of us could work with in order to provide the best educational delivery of services to our members. So you could call that a concession or you could call that an agreement.
Garrett, a concession or agreement, potato, potato. Nevertheless, it took them 27 months. They finally got there. One of the big sticking points was seniority and its use in terms of moving teachers around or hiring into new positions. It looks like the school district now has a lot more flexibility on that front. Does it sound like a reasonable compromise to you?
My understanding from this contract is that seniority is still going to be the prevailing ruling, they're still going to have seniority in the contract. But on top of that too, they're getting about a 4% annual raise, and I can't think of anybody in the private sector who gets a 4% annual raise.
Well, that's sort of on average for the 6 years. They haven't received a raise for the 2 years in which they were negotiating this contract.
Now, I know there was an editorial in the Chicago Sun-Times that talked about how that, you know, due to other provisions in the contract, that some teachers could get raises, as opposed to, you know, this being a 12% raise over 6 years. In some cases, you could see 24-30% raises on average over 6 years, which I find pretty shocking for a union contract.
David, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it's a zero increase the first year, 1% the second year. And I think, this comes We have teacher performance evaluations. It sounds like it's a very workable thing, and what's good here is that there are enough indications to the teacher that she's underperforming along the way. That was one of the things the union insisted on, and I think that's very positive. I'm looking for the positive things here. Also, I think the teachers union was also talking about social workers, more social workers and nurses in the classrooms, and increase in lowering classroom size. If you're talking about getting serious about education, you should also be looking at lowering the size of classes. They wanted to do that. They didn't get their way there. But, you know, this is a very difficult problem. We have high stakes testing now. And what Chicago is showing us is that there is, right from the core of the Obama administration with Rahm Emanuel and also Arne Duncan, who was the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. We have a very strong push. It's a corporate push in terms of educational reform, and it does not bode well for unions or for teachers and parents.
You know, I know in Chicago they're striking, I think, for a 16% deal over 4 years. But in Boston, you know, they didn't strike in, what did you say, it was 27 months. And they're getting a 12% raise over 6 years. So in some ways, you know, this is a win for the city, I think.
But Garrett, Garrett, on the other hand, David brings up this bigger point about not just Chicago, but ed reform sort of from Washington on down. Do you think Boston sort of, both sides sort of work their way through it to come to some sort of a good agreement in the interim?
I'm not sure I entirely understand your question.
I guess what I'm saying is that there seems to be a push across the country for significant reforms in terms of how teachers not only are paid, but their performance reviews. And there were some sticking points in Boston on this front. They seem to have reached an agreement on those.
Yeah, well, I think you've really seen a strong push towards, you know, towards education reform, not, you know, within the classroom, but, you know, things like charter schools and, you know, performance evaluations and an expansion in standardized testing. You've really seen that push since the mid-90s. I think Massachusetts, in a lot of ways, though, has been on the forefront of this, particularly with things like charter schools and Boston. You know, Massachusetts, in a lot of ways, I think, is an incubator for ed reform nationally. And you know, you see some of that reflected in this contract. Is it as much as some people say, you know, at Pioneer, you know, I know Pioneer Institute does a lot of work on this. Is this as much as that they would like? Not necessarily, but I think it's a step in that direction.
Well, let's move on to politics and the race for the U.S. Senate here in Massachusetts. Democrat Elizabeth Warren, who hopes to unseat Republican Scott Brown, released new TV ads this week. They represent a shift from her earlier ads, showing what might be called a softer side. Here's a clip from one of them.
Your fight is Elizabeth Warren's fight.
Elizabeth Warren is on the people's side.
She's fought banks. She's fought Wall Street.
I think she's someone that actually will stick up for the middle class.
Someone that's going to be there for us.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I approve this message.
I think she'd be a great senator.
So a number of Democratic activists and some critics have said that Warren was coming across too strong, too much of an advocate, too hectoring, and was alienating voters. So in this ad, you don't actually hear her very much. You see her talking to voters, putting an arm on a worker, kneeling down and listening to a kid. Latest polls still give Scott Brown a lead in this race. David, are ads like this going to help Elizabeth Warren?
Think about who these ads are for. I think is mind-boggling. Almost everybody has made up his or her mind, pretty much. So now we got people who continue to watch these ads that come just pounding you, and it's like watching a test pattern to me on television. It keeps on, on and on and on. And so we're now trying to convince the people who are the least informed voters of all, and we're doing it with some sort of soft, impressionistic ad. You know, here's the problem for Warren is they've decided apparently that less Warren in these ads is better, but they launch her into a negative ad, and that's going to be a problem for her. Scott Brown, the bottom line on this race is Scott Brown is both immensely likable, and when attacked, he is more persuasive than a hurt puppy.
Well, let me, Garrett, I want to get you into this conversation. Wow. But David mentioned the negative ads, and one of Warren's new ads is filmed at a boxing gym featuring real people calling Elizabeth Warren a real fighter and saying Scott Brown sides with the big money guys, tax cuts for millionaires. So that prompted, speaking of the hurt puppy, this new ad from Scott Brown. Let's listen.
Don't be fooled by Elizabeth Warren's negative attacks.
Like a lot of you, I came from nothing. I'm on your side, fighting for the middle class, an independent voice you can count on to create a stronger economy and more jobs for all of us.
So, Garrett, like you, I came from nothing. Sounds like a pretty effective line. But what do you make of this ad war turning negative?
This race, I've often thought this Senate race for quite a long time has been the dumbest Senate race in the country. And Boston Magazine, I think, did a great job of profiling that. You really had just an endless run of introductory biographical ads from both candidates. And now we're finally, the gloves are coming off. We're finally seeing some issues maybe possibly get injected into this race, as opposed to just like, I'm just such a good guy, I can do all this, or I had a real tough life and I grew up on the jagged edge of the middle class. It's just, oh my God, give me a break. What do you two believe in? What do you guys think about X, Y, and Z? But the thing is, that's not how they're going to win this race, and both of them realize that. They need to, as Dave pointed out earlier, most people have made up their minds on how they're going to vote. So they are fighting over a sliver of the populace that is undecided. And that's who these ads are going to vote
Garrett,
for.
But Garrett, go ahead, Garrett.
I was going to say, and a lot of people, they make their decision, they make their decision based on who they like, who they can relate to. And I think in a lot of ways, Scott Brown is winning on that front because he's a likable guy, whether or not you like his policies or not. He's a likable person.
Here is the issue. How much heat is going to be put on Menino? Menino is the kingmaker here. He has not yet endorsed her. He should have endorsed her. The sooner he endorses, the better for her, the better off she is. He hasn't done it. And the longer he waits, it sends a message to more and more people that he eventually will call on to work. But they will say he's not serious about it because he's calling us in late.
Because he waited too long.
The issue is whether he's in the position of being the kingmaker. Who puts pressure on him to throw his support to her?
Yeah, I think he is to a point, but I'm not sure how strong his political machine is as it once was. I think he definitely still has a huge ability to turn out votes. But let's remember, two of the last races he was involved in, his guys didn't win. So I definitely think he could turn this. But again, this is also a presidential year, so I'm not sure how much of Menino's turnout machine will matter when a lot of people that don't normally vote, people that don't normally pay attention, are going to turn out in droves to vote.
And that certainly presents a huge challenge to Scott Brown with Barack Obama on top of the Democratic ticket in Massachusetts.
There's a real possibility here. For Scott Brown to win, I think he has to run a perfect campaign. He needs to probably take 65-70% of independents, and he needs to pull away probably 25%, we'll say that's being maybe a little higher, but he probably needs 25% of Democrats to win. And he could get that and still lose because so many people are going to turn out to vote for Barack Obama and just vote straight party line ticket. That's a real possibility. I think people that are writing Warren off at this point, that are saying this race is over, she's run a horrendous campaign, they're not looking at I don't think they're looking at the math. I don't think they're looking at
the calendar too. We've still got the debates to go, so there's a lot that can happen in these final 7 or 8 weeks or wherever we are. Well, let's move on very quickly, and I'm going to ask everyone to be abbreviated because time is running out, but our hubbub, that story that didn't make it above the fold. Meghna, let me ask you for your hubbub.
So my hubbub has to do with Emerson College and its Quidditch team because they were practicing
grown-ups running around on brooms.
On brooms, exactly. Yeah, and they were practicing the fine game of Quidditch on Boston Common and were told that, nope, they would be barred because they didn't have a permit. And then, before they could cast a spell and change things around, the city decided instead that it was going to give the Emerson Quidditch team permits to play, so they're back on the common there. And I did think about this. I thought, hey, first of all, they managed to do at least one good thing. They proved that you could speed up the bureaucratic process, so maybe there was a spell out there called Bureaucratico. And two, I think in exchange, they ought to use those brooms to help clean up the common.
Great idea. David, your hubbub.
Another 9/11 has come and gone, and besides thinking about the families and the victims, I think more and more these later years of two people, the only two people in the country who ever lost their jobs because of 9/11, Joe Lawless was the public safety director at Logan Airport, and Ginny Buckingham was the director of Massport. What happened here could have happened in any other airport. Unfortunately, it happened here, and in the clamor to make somebody responsible, to hold somebody responsible, two people who were absolutely blameless lost their jobs. I think about that a lot. I was there throwing questions at them in the days afterwards, but I think of them now, and at some point I hope that there's some public accommodation of them and recognition of the fact that they were unfairly treated.
And Garrett, give us your hubbub.
I've been covering Gary Johnson for Reason extensively. He's a Libertarian Party candidate for president, and you're already starting to hear a lot of spoiler talk. He's going to take the race from Romney, give it to Obama. Well, in the sixth district of Massachusetts, you have another third party candidate, Daniel Fishman, who might play a real factor in the race between Tierney and Tesei, because down ballot races tend to get a larger percentage of third party votes than the top of the ticket. So that's an interesting place where a spoiler, a quote spoiler, could really play a big factor in November.
All right, we'll keep our eye on that. Garrett Quinn, correspondent for Reason Magazine and the author of the Boston Globe blog, Less is More. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And David Boeri, WBUR senior reporter. Always great to have you. Have a
same
great
here,
weekend.
Anthony. Thank you.
And by the way, our conversation on Tuesday about how a Lexington public school confined a student to a small room to control her behavior has sparked some passionate listener response at RadioBoston.org.
School officials say they did nothing wrong, but Minority Report wrote, if that's true, why did they agree to a settlement on the condition that the family maintain absolute confidentiality?
And BZ wrote, unfortunately, without any real evidence, it's a parent's word against theirs. Unless you've ever had to advocate for your child in the public school system, you'll never fully understand what some of us are up against.
The conversation on this and other stories continues on our website at radioboston.org.
So leave your comment there, and while you're at the website, take a look at a special companion piece to yesterday's discussion on poverty in America. It's the story of Harvard's Social Museum and how an upper-crust Bostonian really tried to close the gap between his students and the poor. That's at radioboston.org.
And stay with us. Up next, the disappearing New England accent. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.